On this week's 51%, we chat with rising Broadway star Jasmine Amy Rogers about her Tony-nominated performance in Boop the Musical and how she gets into character for the iconic role of Betty Boop.
Betty shines through the most when I allow myself to shine through. And what I love so much about her is that it feels so similar to myself.
We also learn about the woman behind Barbie. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Today we're talking about some of our favorite feminine icons. Even though they're not real people, these female characters have had a huge impact on popular culture and the way we think about women. We'll start with one of the most famous cartoon characters of all time, Betty Boop. The black and white cartoon was first created in 1930 as really a singing French poodle, but she was quickly reimagined as a caricature of a jazz age flapper, as if to remind those living through the Great Depression of the more carefree roaring 20s. Betty Boop stood out from other female cartoon characters at the time as a sex symbol. Despite her often childish voice and appearance, she represented a sexual woman with an adult audience, and that depiction brought her both scandal and fame. Since 1930, Betty Boop has showed up in countless animated films, TV shows, comic strips, merchandise, and now on Broadway. Boop the Musical brings the character of Betty Boop into the three-dimensional world to flesh out her character for the 21st century. Longing to find herself and escape the constant attention she receives as an icon in her black-and-white cartoon world, Betty Boop is teleported to colorful New York City and finds everyone already knows her there, too. Betty Boop is played by one of Broadway's newest stars. Jasmine Amy Rogers is a 26-year-old actor, singer, and dancer who originated the role in the show's pre-Broadway run in Chicago. When Boop opened at Broadhurst Theater this spring, it was also Rogers' Broadway debut. So far, it's earned her an Outer Critics Circle Award and a Tony nomination for Best Actress in a Musical. The Tony Awards are June 8th. Shortly after her debut, our associate producer Madeline Reynolds spoke with Rogers about her craft, her first Broadway run, and what went into bringing Betty Boop to the stage.
Okay, fellas, key of G, wait, you're saying who?
I feel like we need to start off with a big congratulations on making your Broadway debut as Betty Boop. What was your opening night of Boop like, that experience being your Broadway debut and all?
Oh, well, thank you for your congratulations. It was so special. I always say, like, it's the most beautiful experience that just keeps happening to me. And that night was so wonderful. I felt like I was floating on a cloud the whole night. I wasn't stressed at all. Like, I was just filled with so much joy and love and happiness. It was a dream come true.
Can you give the listeners and myself a little summary of what Boop the Musical is about in your own words, of course, without any major spoilers?
Boop the Musical is about Betty Boop, of course, and she's living her everyday life in, you know, the Toontown black and white cartoon Fleischer world. And she realizes that there's something that's missing in her life. And so she, with the help of her grandfather, Grampy, who is an inventor, she goes on this crazy adventure and ends up in modern day New York City. And, you know, that happens through the act of theater magic. But she goes on this adventure to find love and happiness and acceptance. And she ends up figuring out that the thing she was missing in her life was love, and that when she finds love, it introduces color to her life. So it's a very, very sweet, very, very loving story.
I'm wondering, did you ever have a moment of realization when you said, I'm going to pursue musical theater? Or is this a situation where you've been doing it forever and you can't imagine your life without it?
I don't think I can imagine my life without it. I mean, when I was in high school or when I was in middle school and things like that, I was like, oh, maybe I'll do this, I'll do that. But theater was always what I did. I started doing it when I was about 7 years old. So it's been a part of my life forever. And I think maybe I pretended for a while that it wasn't going to be, you know, my career, because I was like, maybe it's not going to work. But I can't imagine doing anything else, truly.
I can't not talk about the dancing in this show. There are big dance numbers. And as a tap dancer and tap teacher myself, it really makes my heart. God. Yeah, it makes my heart and soul so happy to see tap back on the Broadway stage. I mean, the incredible Jerry Mitchell is the director and choreographer. So, you know, you need to be buckled up for the dancing he's going to teach and create for you. And I think about the opening number of this show, which is A Little Versatility. And from what I've seen, it's a glorious tap number. So I'm wondering, what was your dance journey like? Have you been dancing forever, or did you have to seriously train for this?
I grew up dancing, and the first thing I ever did was tap, actually. My grandmother tapped. And, you know, by the time I was about 12, I had kind of fallen out of it, and I moved cities, so I wasn't in the same dance studio. So when it came to this, I really had to kind of buckle back up and like hit the ground running. And I did 2 weeks of like intense training with Rochelle Rack, who's our associate, just basically on the tap, because I was so out of practice. And it was very, very intense. But luckily, through Chicago and now rehearsing and now being on Broadway, it feels natural, and it feels so exciting, and it's so much fun to do. But that number is a lot. It did take some really great training.
I'm wondering, how did you develop your Betty Boop? As you just said, she's been with you for quite some time, since 2023, because Boop the Musical did an off-Broadway show run in Chicago. But I'm wondering, what was the process to create her? I mean, I know you need to stay true to some of her most defining characteristics of her character, but is there any of you that shines through? And have you found in that process of creating her that you have commonalities with her as well?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of myself shines through. And talking with Jerry and our associate director, D.B. Bonds, they really feel that Betty shines through the most when I allow myself to shine through. And what I love so much about her is that it feels so similar to myself. I think I spent a lot of my life trying not to be a cartoon character. And so now that I get to, it just kind of feels like it all makes sense. And so getting to play her every night, it can be exhausting because she's just so full of energy, but it really is very, very liberating for me to do. And I have found that she just brings so much joy to my life. And of course I at least stayed, you know, honest with, you know, where her voice comes from and her physicalities and things like that. But the fact that I get to mesh that with my own creativity has been so, so exciting.
To kind of talk about the character a little bit more, I mean, she's quite an icon, right? Being considered the first human female animated character to appear in popular media, she is viewed as a sex symbol as well as a female empowerment figure. So I'm wondering, what do you believe your Betty Boop represents and stands for in this show?
I think she represents all of those things. I think, you know, we're not selling sex, but we were saying last week that, you know, there's such a sex appeal that Betty has that just comes by her being, you know? And I think that's really can be very, very empowering for a lot of people. And so I think she has that. And she's also an extreme feminist, and just she stands up for everybody, not just women, but she's the kind of woman that takes care of the people around her in a way that is so selfless. And I think that's what we're trying to show, is that women can be all of these things. They can be brave and courageous and sexy and smart and fun and flirty and silly and cute and like just badass. And I think that's what I'm trying to embody with my Betty.
We have to talk about the music. 16-time Grammy Award winner David Foster, as well, who created, composed the music, and then Tony nominated Susan Birkenhead, who wrote the lyrics. That's quite the pair and duo, I must say. I have listened to the songs that have been released on the platforms, the first one being Where I Want to Be, something to shout about and Why Look Around the Corner. I have listened to them over and over again. I think that's a testament to how good they are. But I believe yourself, David, and even Jerry have stated that Something to Shout About is the 11 o'clock number of this show. It's Betty's big ballad and I think moment of clarity and realization. She takes quite an emotional journey to reach that point. So I'm wondering what it's like to perform that almost every day and what goes through your head during that moment and also preparing yourself for that emotional journey.
Yeah, a lot of it is just, and all of those things, what it really comes down to is I just have to tell Betty's truth and it all kind of falls into place. That is one of the hardest songs. Something to Shout About is one of the hardest songs I've ever sang in my life, and especially coming at the end of like a two and a half hour show. It is very intense. But, you know, I've learned to kind of just trust my instrument and allow myself to just sing. And, you know, David trusts me, which is the most beautiful feeling. And so I just have to tell the truth. And so while, of course, I'm singing this huge number, I'm also just so, I'm more worried about the story and, you know, really getting across to the audience where she is at this moment. So it's not always perfect, but it feels so fulfilling when we get the reaction at the end that we hope for, you know, when people are sniffling because they feel for her that she's gained and lost all of these things in that moment. It's incredible. I love, love, love singing that song.
Nothing entices me, nothing amazes me, unless it's scripted and I'm in the shot. I have nothing to pout about. Listen to me, gee whiz, but God.
This show just seems like a treasure trove of fun. From what I've seen and the clips I've seen, the visuals, the direction, it all just seems so creative. Your sidekick, your lovely puppy sidekick pal is Pudgy, who is played by Philip Huber, which is a puppet. He's so cute. This show just seems like a lot of fun. So on the topic of fun, is there a moment on stage where you are just having the time of your life? In particular, any fun moment?
You know, speaking of Where I Want to Be, which is our act one closer, Betty's big number where, you know, she's revealed as Betty Boop. I'm on stage with almost the entire cast. And I have this moment where I'm standing in front of them and they're all facing me and they're looking at me. And I love that moment because, you know, in that moment, she's really just letting it all hit the wall in that moment, and she's getting to be fun and silly and goofy, and the fact that I get to do that and look at all of them while I'm doing it is so much fun. And there are a lot of moments where I'm just like, I'm really laughing because I love these people so much and I love what we're doing and what we're creating. So it really just like is endless joy, and it creates a really, really amazing work environment, I will say.
That is a plus, I will say. Yeah, that sounds like a plus.
Yeah.
So the costumes, hair, and makeup in this musical, from what I've seen, looks so beautiful. Your Betty looks on point. And is there a moment when you are getting Betty-fied that you say to yourself, Jasmine is gone and Betty is here? And does it help you ever get into character, putting on the wig and that styled makeup?
For sure. I mean, getting my eyebrows glued down every night and then redrawn on my face is definitely a full transformative moment. And then when I get to put that wig on, it really just all comes together. And it really just feels so, you can't not be Betty in that moment because I look like Jasmine, but I don't look like Jasmine. You know, I mean, like my phone still opens at my face, you know, but it's totally a different girl. And the facial expressions that I create in that face are so different and so full of a different life. So it really is a transformation.
So I am always curious about this. It always crosses my mind. And it is what the actors and actresses do in the wings right before they make their first entrance onto stage. So my question to you is, what do you do in the wings right before you make your first entrance as Betty Boop? Do you have any ritual? Are you just, you're calm, cool, and collected? What's happening around you?
We actually, as a cast, not all of us, but the people who are available, we get together, we circle up. Someone will usually say something or say something silly, and then we put our hands into the circle and like a little cheer. And then once we get into places, in my first entrance, I am behind this little cutout, I'll say. And there are two boys on either side of me, and one of my girls is behind me, and she does a couple things back there. So I say hi to both of them, and then I give a high five to the girl behind me, and then I take a centering breath, and then we just start. And once the music starts, you know, sometimes we'll have like little asides to each other, but we're just waiting for it to begin. But I feel like we've really lived in it for a good amount of time, that we just feel grounded and locked in and safe with each other. So it's not too much. But and then on the other scenes when I'm backstage, we're doing all sorts of things. I mean, yesterday we were making each other laugh, and I was drinking water and I literally spit water onto one of my castmates' costume, and she had to go on like that. So a very crazy, very fun backstage area.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
It's chaotic. It's great.
Jasmine, What do you hope audiences walk away with after seeing Boop the Musical?
I truly hope they walk away with a smile plastered on their face. It's been so nice to come out every night and have people say, oh my gosh, my cheeks hurt because I haven't stopped smiling this whole time. And I hope they walk out feeling loved and seen. And I hope they feel inspired to love other people and see other people for who they are and to treat people around them with kindness and joy. And I hope they remember that they are capable of so much. All they have to do is just reach out and grab it.
Jasmine, it was truly a pleasure, and I wish you and the entire cast of Boop the Musical all the luck and just to break legs.
Thank you so, so much. Thank you for having me. This was very lovely. I enjoyed myself.
That was actor, singer, and dancer Jasmine Amy Rogers speaking with our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds. Rogers is the star of Boop the Musical on Broadway, and her portrayal of Betty Boop has earned her a Tony nomination for Best Actress. The 78th Annual Tony Awards airs Sunday, June 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern on CBS and Paramount+. You can learn more about Boop the Musical at boopthemusical.com.
Unless you forget there's me, I'm not gonna go away.
Barbie is still having a moment from the hit 2023 movie of the same name. Very similar in theme to Boop the Musical, now that I think of it. But really, when is Barbie ever not having a moment? Barbie is one of the most popular dolls in the world, on the market for more than 6 decades. It was not easy getting there, though. A recent lecture at Russell Sage College in Troy, New York, focused on Barbie's humble beginnings and the life of Ruth Handler, the woman who invented her.
One of the great things about Ruth Handler was you couldn't back her off. She believed so much in this idea that she moved from belief to action.
That's Robin Gerber, our lecturer. Gerber is a best-selling author and historian whose work has appeared on CNN, the History Channel, and the Washington Post. Her latest book is Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Gerber says Ruth Handler was born Ruth Mosco in 1916 in Denver, Colorado. Gerber says Ruth was the youngest of 10 children, and she was actually raised by her oldest sister, Sarah, because their mother had fallen ill. Gerber says that likely gave Ruth an up-close look at how to run a business, as Sarah managed a local cafe. It also encouraged Ruth to grow up fast, and by age 22, she was living in California, working at Paramount Studio, and married to her husband, an artist named Izzy Elliott Handler.
They would go on to have a 60-year amazing marriage and, of course, business partnership.
Elliott made things like bookends, table lamps, and ashtrays, and Ruth began to market and sell them, even landing contracts with businesses like the Douglas Aircraft Company. Eventually, a colleague of Elliott's, Harold Matt Mattson, entered the fold, but only for about a year or so. Despite this, the name of the company became Mattel, for Matt and Elliott.
Which was something Ruth always resented. And you'll see toward the end of her life, she remedied that for herself.
Gerber says toys were a part of Mattel's product line from its early days. Gerber says Ruth and Elliott had two rules when it came to toys. One, they had to be unique, and two, they needed to use mechanisms that could be used in other Mattel toys. The music in a jack-in-a-box, you could also find it in a toy guitar. Gerber says Elliott would be in charge of designing the toys, and Ruth would handle production and marketing. And quickly, toys became a major part of their brand.
Now we're into the 1950s. Of course, there's a huge surge of families and children. And in the 50s, there were lots of cowboys and westerns on television. And so the men in the design department were making guns. They made the Fanner 50 pistol and rifles, rockets. That was a good thing. And they didn't make really toys that appealed to girls other than they did make musical toys.
That's where Barbie comes in. Gerber says Ruth noticed most dolls at that time looked like toddlers or babies. They essentially let girls practice being mothers, and that's about it. But Ruth's daughter, Barbara, was playing with paper dolls to role-play other aspects of adulthood with her friends.
Little girls just want to play at being big girls. And so she went to Elliot and the guys and said, we need to make an adult toy for girls, adult woman doll. And they said, don't be ridiculous, Ruth. Go back to managing the company. You do that really well. No mother is going to buy her daughter a doll with breasts. Several years went by of her trying to convince these men that they really needed to make an adult doll. And then the Handler family took a vacation to Europe, a family vacation in Europe. And in Luzern, Switzerland, they walked by a toy shop, but in the window of this toy shop was a doll. This doll was dressed in fantastic clothes, very beautiful clothing. And Barbara says to her mother, I want one of those. And Ruth says, yeah, I want one too. And they went inside. Ruth actually bought three, came back to California and said to Jack Ryan, who was the head of her department that manufactured, the head of the whole operation, she said, take this to Japan and start manufacturing this doll.
Ruth named the resulting doll Barbie after Barbara. When Barbie debuted at the American International Toy Fair in New York City in 1959, Gerber says Ruth was told pretty much the same thing. No mother would buy a doll with breasts, even if their daughters loved it, because it looked too sexual. Ruth left the fair crushed, but she had another trick up her sleeve in the form of psychoanalyst and marketer Ernest Dichter. Dichter told Ruth to market Barbie as basically a teenage fashion model for girls to practice grooming and hygiene. Ruth ran with that and did something that not a lot of toy companies at the time were doing. She ran a television ad.
Someday I'm gonna be exactly like you. Till then I know just what I'll do.
Barbie was a hit. At $3 a pop, Mattel sold roughly 300,000 Barbies in its first year. Today, Mattel has Barbies of different shapes, sizes, races, and hairstyles. There's been a Dr. Barbie and a Teacher Barbie, a Frida Kahlo Barbie and an Amelia Earhart Barbie. Of course, Mattel eventually launched a boyfriend for Barbie, named after the handler's son, Kenneth. And Barbie has lots and lots of clothing. Ruth knew from the start that selling different outfits would keep people buying even if they already owned a doll. Gerber says nearly every major clothing designer has at one point used Barbie as a model. And by the 1970s, Mattel was investing in other areas. It bought a movie company. It even bought Barnum & Bailey's Circus.
They bought those with stock. The problem was that in the early 70s, Mattel had some problems. There was a factory fire in Mexico. There was a downturn in sales that would have devalued the stock so that some of these deals would have been lost. To keep that from happening, Ruth cooked the books and she got caught. She had her Martha Stewart moment.
Gerber says Ruth was fined and sentenced to community service. She and Elliot were ultimately forced to leave Mattel over the scandal. And around the same time, Ruth was diagnosed with breast cancer. Gerber says it was one of the most difficult periods of Ruth's life, but it gave her another idea. What if she could make a realistic prosthetic for breast cancer patients?
And so she calls some old friends at Mattel. She gets some of the soft material they use for baby dolls. And she puts this company together. And what does she call it? Remember we talked about her feelings about Mattel? She calls it Ruthton. It was a good business. It absolutely made money. And more than that, it was a wonderful thing for Ruth.
In the late 1990s, the first woman CEO of Mattel, Jill Barad, invited Ruth back to the company to help build the Barbie brand. Ruth died a few years later, in 2002, from complications during surgery for colon cancer. She was 85. Gerber says she feels honored to tell Ruth's story. She says her legacy is one of resilience, ingenuity, and persistence.
Ruth had what I call a bias for action. And I think that's a wonderful thing to develop. And I would say to you, have your great ideas, but think about, are you developing your bias for action? What's the next step?
The name of Gerber's book is Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Gerber spoke at a recent virtual lecture hosted by Russell Sage College in Troy, New York. You can learn more about Russell Sage and its programs at sage.edu. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete, sweet melting little girl dreams. They said, oh,